You're listening to Special Education Matters, a regular podcast about things that matter in special education. I'm your host, Michael Bohl, and I am the proud father of an 18-year-old boy with autism. Many of us have noticed the increase in students diagnosed with disabilities such as autism. These numbers include students like my son whose disabilities significantly impact his ability to live independently. This nearly crushing increase in numbers of individuals for whom lifetime care is required is putting pressure on our communities, states, and systems. Jill Escher, mother of two children with profound disabilities, is taking on this challenge in her role as president of NCSA, the National Council on Severe Autism. We discuss the challenges ahead and the commitments society must make to help some of the most vulnerable individuals in our society. Jill Escher, thanks so much for joining me on the program today.
Happy to be here, Michael.
Well, we're going to talk about the NCSA, the National Council on Severe Autism, which I'm excited to talk about because I have a son with severe autism. And now that he is similar to your son's 22, my son's 21, it's like, oh, now what do we do? A lot of the supports that were in place all the way through their youth are starting to dissipate or disappear. And what do we do next? And so why don't you tell us a little bit about the NCSA, what it's all about, please?
Sure. NCSA is a pretty young organization. We're a nonprofit. We got started about 2 years ago, and essentially it was a bunch of people who, mostly leaders in the autism community, mostly mothers, but also some fathers and some practitioners, who became increasingly concerned about what looked like a very large void in the advocacy circles in autism. There was increasing emphasis on what I would call high-functioning autism or, you know, verbal autism, and less emphasis on those with profound needs, people who may be nonverbal, who may have severe learning disabilities, intellectual disabilities, people who really failed to develop basic life skills, basic adaptive skills, people who might have aggression, self-injury, and other comorbidities. So as this population became less preferred, less groovy, and more invisible, it really became clear that we had to do more to advocate on their behalf. So that was really the very practical, boring genesis of NCSA. We just wanted to fill that advocacy void.
And when you say fill that advocacy void, like where do you find yourself focusing most of your time? Looking through your website, it talks about having a focus on policy, research, awareness. Is it all of those things just sort of generally bringing more understanding to it all versus building 16 homes or something like that?
Right. So we are not a direct service provider. We don't even provide direct, you know, legal advice or intervention advice. We are basically here to serve as a platform to amplify the voice of this community. And when I say amplify this voice, you know, it's through various means. We have obviously a website. We have position statements. We have a newsletter. We do outreaches, you know, to particular, you know, legislators on particular topics. We have a webinar series. We're going to have our first policy summit. That's just a short half-day online event on March 25th. It's going to be free. That registration will go up soon. And that will really focus on the primary policy issues that are confronting this population. These are things that really don't get much traction in more traditional, conventional autism circles. So I have nothing against other autism advocacy groups. In fact, I used to be president of Autism Society San Francisco Bay Area. I worked very closely with Autism Society. I've worked very closely with Autism Speaks. I don't really begrudge them at all. I think they do fantastic work in their way. But one thing they were not doing emphatically was representing, you know, this one third of the spectrum. So really, that's what we're trying to do, to give a voice to our stories, give a voice to our realities, to come up with ideas, right, to advance policies that will really, really, you know, tangibly help these families and help these individuals because they've been lost from the discussion.
Well, let's talk about those policies. So, you know, one third is a big number, right? And so that's a big chunk. We're not talking like, you know, 10% or something or 5%. So what are some of those needs? Like, what sort of policy changes are you looking to push? What's on your horizon there?
Right. So, you know, there are, let me put it this way. We are in the midst of a massive and growing autism crisis, particularly as it pertains to adults. You know, we've really trivialized for a long time just how bad, you know, things are. And I want to start by talking about data. People are always roll their eyes like, oh, Jill's talking about data again. It's so boring.
But I'll try not to.
Okay. You can't understand the pickle we're in unless you know how bad, right, the numbers are.
Sure. Okay,
so I don't know Oregon's numbers. I'm sorry. I know you're in Oregon. I'm in California. I know California's numbers inside and out. So for example, in the state of California, in our developmental services system, we had 3,000 autism cases 35 years ago. Mm-hmm. In the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. That number is now 133,000. Okay, from 3,000 to 133,000 autism right. cases. And these just aren't any autism cases. These are only the developmental disability level autism cases. This is comparing apples to apples, okay. right? This isn't about broadening diagnostics. When you add the other parts of the spectrum, right, the number's actually much higher, and you see that reflected in the educational data. So we see a 44-fold increase in our state in 35 years, right? So what does that mean for the future? Well, almost, you know, the vast majority of these cases are kids under the age of 18, right? There are going to be twice as many, three times as many, four times as many, five times as many adults with significantly mm-hmm. disabling autism just in the coming, you know, two decades. It is an outrageously huge number, an unprecedented challenge. Now, I'm not saying, okay, this is California data. Does it apply to every other state? You know, if you look at the CDC data, which shows very similar trends as California, yeah, it probably does. It probably does.
I mean, we know there's a lot of engineers in California, but that's not going to account for the...
No, that doesn't account. Believe me, engineers don't explain autism at all. There's really no proof of that. There's so many stupid theories. I could do a whole podcast with you about stupid theories about autism.
The top 10.
The top 10 stupid theories. Vaccines, you know,
radio waves. No, bad mother's my favorite.
Bad mothering.
Oh my
God, we should do that episode. Yeah.
It's definitely not bad fathering.
Yeah, really. You guys are exempt.
Yep.
You know, that gets to the heart of what's going on here. We have an unprecedented population of very severely disabled adults, and that population is growing and growing and growing every year. And we are not increasing capacity and options and funding remotely at the rate that's needed to address the needs. In fact, we're doing the opposite. We're putting our head in the sand and we're saying, what autism crisis? Autism, it's something that's always been here and we just never noticed it before. It's like, no, anybody could look at the data and see that that's not true. So, we do need to very seriously have a discussion at the national level about how are we going to spend, you know, very precious Medicaid dollars and other funds, right, mm-hmm. on this population. Should this population be a priority, for example, for housing vouchers? Should this population be a priority for certain types of work programs? Go ahead. I'm sorry, Michael.
Well, there's so much more to that. As you know, there's the wraparound supports that go with this group. And this particular group can't really often stay at home. We're talking, there's violence and aggression issues and everything. Yes. It's not like you can say, I'll just keep them in the house.
So, often that is true. And, you know, and when you talk to parents around the country who are trying to get the in-home supports mm-hmm. that they need to deal with a kid who is breaking the furniture, who is breaking the windows, who is, you know, tackling their mother, you know, it's who's eloping from the house naked, or, you know, all these things that are actually mm-hmm. become pretty common stories.
Right.
They often can't even get the in-home support, much less the supports the adult needs to live out of the house. And let's just be honest here, right? You, me, the parents listening to this program, we're just, you know, physiological beings and we're going to die. We're going to mm-hmm. become ill. We're going to die. In fact, as I speak to you right now, my husband's in the hospital. You know, with an emergency condition that hopefully will be remedied. But, you know, we're mortal. So even if the best case scenario that, you know, we're able to take care of our challenging children over the long haul, it's still a temporary Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. It's still temporary. what do people expect is going to happen to this population? That siblings, to the extent they even exist and are willing to do it, that the siblings will, you know, just jump on board and, you know, take on this work, you know, for no money. I mean, I think that that's very unrealistic, but, you know, that's kind of the de facto expectation. So we need to have these very serious conversations. And what's happened in the autism world is you've seen the priorities like so bizarrely shift in another direction. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, should we talk about the puzzle piece? Who cares? Should we talk about, you know, an autistic person or a person with autism? Who cares? You know, should we, disband all, you know, sub-minimum wage jobs because, you know, we feel it's a violation of their civil right? Who cares? These things are so trivial, you know, compared to the massive crisis this country is facing. And we're looking at, you know, these diversions. It's almost like, oh, there's a bright, shiny object. Let's look at that instead of looking at the real problem.
So, you know, you've articulated what the problem is. And so you talked about policy solutions. So building capacity, I mean, what are some, I guess, how do you go on, what route do you take to get to building capacity? There's the government funding option, there's private foundational options, and perhaps it's not a binary choice anyways, but what are you looking or supporting or advocating for the future to create capacity?
Okay. Well, let me just start off by saying that this problem is $1 trillion a year problem. It really is $1 trillion a year problem. It's huge. And we are not such policy geniuses that we can pull something out of the hat and say, oh, voila, here is the policy solution, right, to this massive societal problem. There are things that need to be done in the near term, however. I think the long term is a much harder question. Mm-hmm. In the near term, we need a mindset that is all about a complete continuum of care, right, across all ability levels, across all settings, across all realities, across all financial wherewithals, right, for all families. Right now, the mentality has been about narrowing options. Like, for example, I mentioned employment. So there's been a strong movement headed by the disability rights community to discontinue sub-minimum wage job programs.
That happened here in Oregon.
Yeah, it did.
It's gone now.
And yeah, it's gone. And I'm like, okay, like that's fine if you want to move people with disabilities into competitive integrated employment. I have no problem with that. But you have to acknowledge that there is quite a sizable subpopulation that is completely incapable of that. Mm. So what are you going to do to address their needs for meaningful day activities, right? If you take away, you know, these jobs programs, that's not happening. It's just about it's about defunding, discontinuing, shuttering programs, closing the doors, instead about opening doors, right, to new ideas and new concepts. It's much cheaper and much easier to discontinue something than it is to start something new. And the disability rights community seems to be perfectly happy, right, kind of excluding our population from their, you know, list of objectives.
So do you see
very disheartening. Yeah.
Do you see rays of hope, though? Like, you talked about things that are shutting down, making it more difficult, but do you see rays of hope or things that are emerging out there?
Not yet. Mm-hmm. No, I don't see rays of hope yet. I don't. I mean, I hope that, as our platform grows, as our community grows, as our voice becomes louder, that, you know, these types of defunding policies will become, you know, less easy, right, for politicians to do. Right. I mean, another example is with Medicaid. I don't want to get too much in the weeds and bore your listeners to death, but, you know, we've seen the same movement with respect to Medicaid dollars. And Medicaid dollars are our children's lifelines, right? This is the money, or at least most, it's half the money that supports their adult day programs, that supports their adult housing, you know, residential services.
So you're talking about federal dollars that then the states, depending on the state, will add to or not.
Exact or not, as in many cases.
Depending where you live,
exactly. California does, match kind of sort of 50% kind of sort of. So, there's been a strong movement, again, the disability rights community to narrow the number of options, right, available for Medicaid dollars to be used. And whereas we're like, no, we need to expand the options, and we have to include the needs of the severe autism community in what's fundable. But we have been, this community has been sidelined and pushed aside. Again, I won't get into the weeds about it, but you can find a number of trends like this across many different areas. And it's very concerning that our community has been shut out and ignored. We're very easy to shut out and ignore. Sure. We're expensive. Yeah. We're complex, right? We're hard.
We're not, nonverbal.
They're nonverbal. They can't even speak for themselves, yeah. Right? They don't know what's going on. There's no question that we can't, build Rome in a day. That's not going to happen. But we can build roads, right? So that we can build Rome
or canals.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Or canals. Now, I think Rome was mostly roads, right?
Well, they had a few canals.
And sewers.
In the cities, yeah.
Yeah. So
aqueducts. How about that? Aqueducts.
Oh, aqueducts. Yes. Very good. That's really we're trying to set the stage, I think, so that we can become a stronger voice and can make changes in the future. These changes will not happen tomorrow. The entrenched disability advocates, which, by the way, I think do some good work, right, for their own constituencies, and I don't again begrudge them, their efforts at all. But they have ignored the needs of this community. This community is not cute or darling or special to them. Mm-hmm. So we do not advance their agenda for inclusion and empowerment. We advance a different kind of agenda. Our kids need something that's a little different. So we have to have that voice.
So you're at the beginning stages of this all.
I think so. Uh-huh. I really think so. I mean, there's only so much you can do in a short amount of time, especially with something as costly and complex as this.
Right. And so you've given a clear understanding of what the problem is. So where's the first steps, do you think, to start?
Well, I mean, the first steps, I mean, to say this again, we need the seat at the table, right? Okay. We have to be there. When decisions are being made about our Medicaid dollars, we have to be there.
Okay, and where's that seat? Like, you're talking at a federal level then to be a lobbyist, in a sense, advocating for that.
Not quite a lobbyist. I mean, a lot of organizations are represented on committees, uh-huh. on, councils, on task forces.
Okay.
There are a number of them that are disability centric or autism centric, or Medicaid centric. And we need to be a voice when it comes to all of those discussions. That's the first step. The second step is to really, bring out the soldiers and fight certain battles.
And
those battles have to be well defined. You don't believe me, autism parents, here's the other thing that's really, really important to understand. Autism parents are mostly burnt out. Right?
Sure. Yeah.
They're burnt out and it's not that they don't care, but they don't have, the time or the energy to pour into advocacy that other disability advocates do. Mm-hmm. They can't travel most of the time, right? They can't go to meetings most of the time. They're home taking care of really severely disabled children and young adults. So, it adds another level of challenge to our work. That other groups can call up the troops and things can happen. Well, our troops are like, give me my fifth cup of coffee. I can't even wake up.
I haven't slept. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting. Now that my son has moved to a residential placement in the last 4 months. Oh, it's like, there's a whole different level of energy. I can start doing stuff again.
Yeah. Sleep is a really important thing for people. I spent years without sleep, so I understand.
I hear you. So, Jill, we're coming towards the end of our time here, and I'd like to usually ask a question more about the horizon. So it sounds like, again, we're back at the beginning stages of this. Where do you hope things will go or be if we were to talk 10 years from now?
Well, first I want to say, go to our website and sign up for our newsletters, our alerts, sign up for our Facebook page. So we're ncsautism.org.
Okay. And I'll make sure that's on the show notes, of course, as well. So.
Okay. All right. People don't usually check the show notes.
Yeah, I know. No, so you got to give a plug. I hear you.
And then on Facebook, we're pretty active. You can just type in National Council on Severe Autism. We'll pop up. We have a blog, we have a newsletter. And so I think the first step for people is just to know who we are, see some of our materials, learn about what we stand for. We have policy statements published on our website on a number of topics that really express some of our core values. But what's next? I think over time, we have to grow as an organization and become mobile much more mobile at the federal level and at the state level. Right now, we are an all-volunteer organization. We do not have staff. I think we will go in a much more kind of professionalized direction as we get more resources, more funding, and more people on board. We do have a number of committees that help us. We have an events committee, a policy mm-hmm. committee, a social media committee. They've all been very helpful. If people are interested in volunteering with us, there are some options available. People, we've had more than 100 people contribute to our blog on a number of topics relating to severe autism. We welcome contributions like that. So we love to hear from people. And so what's it going to be in 10 years from now? That's a little hard for me to predict, but
what are you hoping for realistically?
I think that in 10 years, hopefully every single person in America recognizes autism for the crisis that it is. Right. And that there's no more sugarcoating this. There's no more unicorns and rainbows and, trivializing like autism as some sort of like natural difference to be celebrated. I mean, that might be true for some people and that's all fine,
sure.
But that's definitely not true for, I would say, the vast majority of people affected by autism. So number one, hopefully the awareness is authentic. The awareness encompasses the urgency of this situation. Number two, that we have policies that are realistic, that we don't just defund, subminimum wage programs, but that we fund programs that actually address the needs of these adults who can't care for themselves and who can never earn a living, right? So we need huge doses of reality, and a real lifespan approach. Like right now, there's so much emphasis on early identification, early intervention, when in my mind, I hate to say this, there's not a huge amount of data showing that those efforts necessarily pay off. In some cases they do, but
I do remember spending, quitting work and spending a lot of hours. I don't regret it. I can't compare to what it would have been like had I not done that, but.
Yeah. Well, the data is not very strong, to be honest. So we need really a lifespan approach to thinking about autism expenditures and autism programming and a lot less emphasis on the early years.
All right. Jill Escher, thank you so much for your time today and giving us all your information and the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Michael. I love speaking with you.
Thanks for listening to another edition of Special Education Matters. For more information, including show notes, head to our website, csnlg.com/listen. And if you like what you hear, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. Those reviews bring us lots of happiness. I'm your host, Michael Bull, and we will talk again soon.